The castle has just so many incredible sounds. It's just full of music. I think the most striking thing is in the castle gatehouse, very, very early in the morning, before anyone has got there, and it's just inhabited by swallows, and they sing their hearts out. The castle is about 12 or 13 acres within its walls, and this is just really one big open field. In the springtime, it can be full of skylarks. I've heard linnets up there and a wren on one occasion.
It sounds corny almost, really, but the buzz of the insects and the call of the birds. But that is what we have. It's just a gentle sort of background sound of the sea. And there's nothing else to remind you, really, of the 21st century, 20th century, whatever.
At any time of the year, you hear the sea in any condition, whether it's a calm sea or a stormy sea. And then the cliff on the southern side that the castle stands on in the summertime is full of nesting kittiwakes, and they're just making the most incredible raucous kittiwake, 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 kittiwake.
It's just incredibly dramatic. It looks like a castle that's been painted for a theatre backdrop or something. It sort of sits there on the horizon almost in 2D, looking like a set of jagged broken teeth and absolutely black against the sky, and it sits there looking like that throughout your journey towards it, whether you're coming from the south, from Craster, or from the north. It really dominates the approach the whole way. It's incredibly dramatic.
What we're looking at is a finger of rock pointing out to sea, which is higher than the rest of the land, and it almost looks like the shape of a wave. It's the most extraordinary curve with a pointed end, and on top of this wave you can see the ruins of the castle, and they're quite jagged. The outline of them is almost like a hand, like fingers sticking up out of the rock.
Like so many of the dramatic sites in Northumberland, it's sitting on an outcrop of the Wind Sill, this very hard rock, which comes to the sea here on the coast at Dunstanburgh and, of course, continues out to the Farne Islands.
Physically, its place in the landscape is really prominent and dramatic. If you look at the way it's sort of pushed up through the rock that surrounds it, and everything around it is twisted and changed by the violence of that basalt, and I find that incredibly striking.
It was Thomas of Lancaster who built the castle in 1313, and historians have debated for centuries almost why it was built, and the location of the castle is one of the strangest things about it, and that's in a way what I think gives a lie to the long-established historical view that it's to do with defending against the Scots invasions. It's well off the main lines of approach from the north. It's stuck out in the middle of nowhere. It's actually more than a mile from the settlement of Embleton, which it's supposedly protecting. So it's been something of an enigma for many years why this spot was chosen. Clearly it's a naturally defensible spot. It's got cliffs on two sides and the sea on the other two sides and marsh all round the base of the outcrop. So it is naturally defensible, but why Thomas of Lancaster should pick this spot rather than somewhere close to the village of Embleton or somewhere that actually did something useful in strategic defending the country terms is a matter of debate, and I think probably the answer is that the drama that appeals to us today of the natural setting was equally appealing to him as a designer of a grand landscape, a grand lordly landscape.
Why a castle in that particular place? Well, the country was descending into anarchy because the king at the time, Edward II, was really not a very good king, because instead of dispensing patronage and money and power and influence to all the barons in the land, he was channeling all his patronage into his favourites, in particular somebody called Gaveston. And what that meant for all the landowners in far-flung places like Northumberland was that they couldn't govern properly in turn. And so things like the raids of the Scots were happening much more regularly, and the country was descending into anarchy. So Thomas of Lancaster needed something to demonstrate that he had power himself and that he could offer law and order in this very unlawful part of the country in a way that the king could not. And that was why he built this castle, as a sort of demonstration of his power to be a good lord, if you like. And that might be quite hard for us to understand in the 20th century, but if you think about it, in an age when people couldn't read and write, their eyes meant a lot more to them. And it was really like a piece of theatre. It was like, here is a demonstration of what I can do. And it's so visually striking. It's meant to be seen from far away. And the recent discoveries that it was in fact surrounded by all these wonderful mirrors lend a lot of strength to that argument that it was simply built as a piece of visual propaganda. Because if you imagine it surrounded by water, immediately it conjures up other pictures, other images. And in the imagery of the time in medieval England, what people would immediately have thought of was King Arthur. That all seems a bit corny to us now, but it was a message with huge political significance in medieval times, because King Arthur was an image of kingship that was an ideal kingship. And so if the king was demonstrably not able to give good lordship and to govern properly, then here was somebody who could. So this was an amazing piece of political theatre.
A sort of child's picture book castle. You've got the great drum towers facing us as we come up from the south, and the ruins of the Lilburn Tower standing out on the skyline, and then a great stretch of the Curtain Wall running down towards the sea.
It seems to grow out of that place, out of that rock. It seems to belong there, and it's been reclaimed by nature, and it's just this ruined place and a sort of dead place in that sense, and yet it's the most alive place. It's teeming with life, with natural life.
The walls that are still standing, the way they've been used by nature since its abandonment is fascinating.
And every little nook and cranny is occupied by something, you know, whether it's a bird or a plant or an insect or a lichen, something is growing there. And I love that sense of what humans have left behind being sort of reclaimed by nature and redeemed by nature.
When you look at all the stones here, every stone is covered with lichen and moss. And that's the building block for the rest of the colonization of plants and the birds that breed here. It's austere like the rest of the environment, but it's been recolonized virtually completely.
So I'm walking to it across the sand. And the sand here is lovely. It's real sort of golden, soft sand, and it's quite dry and hard to walk through, so you're walking heavily through this sand.
We come round to the north side of the castle. We're just passing through the northern outer defences. Very fragmentary now, just stones picking their way out through the turf.
And then suddenly you reach the end of the beach, and it's completely different. It's a really changed landscape. Instantly, it's covered with these great, huge, black, round boulders that look like something otherworldly. They're like great dinosaur droppings, huge black stones.
And you can actually see the rocks as they get smaller and rounder. And they go right down, oh, quarter of a mile down to a sandy beach. And as they get to the sandy beach, they're what's called Dunstanborough marbles. They're down to football-sized rocks that are virtually round, whereas they start up as several metre square black block.
There's a rock at the far corner of the headland that it stands on, which is called the Rumbling Churn. And I think in previous generations it was probably even more rumbling than it is now. I think it's fallen away a bit, but you still hear the sea just booming in there.
were just coming into view of the Gold Crag on the north side of the castle, where the Windsill outcrop is perhaps at its most dramatic, with the sea bashing up against the foot of the cliffs. And you're probably beginning to pick up the sound of kittiwakes nesting on the cliff itself.
The kittiwakes at the moment are falling off this dark rock into the sunlight. They're a stunning bird with their fluttering, almost tern-like flight, delicate flight, with very, very white heads during the breeding season, yellow bills, black legs, and these inky black wingtips. A true seabird, in that it lives at sea most of the time, and of course it has to come to shore to nest, and that's basically the only time that it does so.
Because they're such sociable birds, if one comes back with food, even though there are probably 200 of them on the ledge, they all shout together thinking that the food's for them, and it all rises like a great chorus.
At the moment we've got 40 to 50 razorbills sat on the water, and they also use the cliff face here. Strangely, although they've been recorded regularly perched on the cliffs, they've never been recorded nesting, the same as the guillemot. We do have shag on there at the moment. There's a breeding pair with two very large, ugly chicks. The most amazingly prehistoric looking chicks. But great characters. It's interesting how we're sitting under the north-facing part of the castle, and there's not a single sign of a wall, because the cliff here, defended by the gulls, are the castle wall itself. All the defensive man-made structures are along the more vulnerable south and west-facing sides. But here, nature itself defends the castle, totally impenetrable, with the sea beneath and the sheer cliff. And here the kittiwakes sit, like a forgotten army, as it were. And also the formers along the top also could be seen as marine soldiers defending the castle. They're able to defend themselves about pretty well anything. So they can eject this foul-smelling oil, and not just foul-smelling, but very, very sticky oil, that if birds get it on their feathers, it'll basically just mean they can't fly. And the sort of chemical warfare that they're using there, which is highly effective in this case.
And then you walk up into a field, and in my memory and in my imagination of the castle, the field is always full of larks singing, because you hear skylarks from the very earliest spring.
Right, well, we're down on what is historically thought of as the Great Moat. There's water in front of us. Reeds growing, there's rushes, we've got house martins, lots of house martins flying around us at the moment, feeding on the insects coming off the water. This, when managed by the people who lived at the castle, would have been used for production of fish, possibly carp. It's a major defensive system as well. If you imagine this whole area just being a wet land, this would have been very difficult to cross.
On a stormy day, you might still smell the salt of the sea spray. But on a spring day, you'd probably be smelling the young grass and that sweetness. And often, if the wind's from the south, which it often is, you smell gorse and that wonderful, warm coconut smell that gorse has blowing across.
Along with the blaze of yellow in the spring, we have these perching yellowhammers. They sit on top. And with their canary yellow body, they can look a stunning sight on top of the gorse. And of course, there's this very familiar bird call. Some say it sounds like a little bit of bread and no cheese.
You walk round the sort of curve of the great hill that the castle stands on, and you're right underneath the Lilburn Tower. And underneath this Lilburn Tower, there are these incredible pillars of basalt. They look like giants. They look like stone giants. You can't really tell where the tower, the man-made bit, begins and where these stones end.
We've now got regular swallows and house martins flying over. This is where they come to gather the mud to build the nest in the castle. The swallow is certainly breeding in the castle. Pied wagtail just been hovering over the sort of murky-looking section of the water there. It's presumably getting insects off the surface. There's a reed bunting just flown through, and that's certainly nesting in this branch bur reed that we have in front of us.
You come round the curve of the hill and then suddenly you see the gatehouse and the gatehouse wall, which is another surprise, really. It's so dramatic.
Well, the most dramatic thing that folk nearly always comment on is this fantastic erosion, the way that the sandstone has been furrowed by the effect of the wind whistling through this part of the site.
And they're just wonderful, because every stone is different, and they're all sort of scratched and etched by the wind and gouged and pitted. Everyone has this incredible pattern and colour, and depending on the time of day, you get these wonderful rich reds and oranges, and sometimes when the sun is shining directly on it, it's almost bleached of colour.
The winds here, as we're exposed to the northeast, are ferocious. Winter particularly does produce these violent storms from the east, and we're totally unprotected for that.
Each scratch in the stone is an inch deep, so it's this most incredible sort of sculptural experience to touch it. And it's quite rough and dry and sandy, because it's sandstone and it's a very gritty feeling.
And then you've got the dramatic architecture of the original gateway here, with its arrangements and machicolations for firing down on anybody who's coming here. And then the portcullis slots and so on in, the ribs of the great vault over our head. The size of the gateway here is about twice the height of a man, maybe reaching up to 12 feet, something like that.
Because the air has to rise over the rock and the castle buildings, it has to speed up, and therefore there's always a breeze. So there's always a rush of air through doorways or windows where you didn't expect it, because it's a still day. Maybe that's why it feels a little bit ghostly sometimes, and maybe chill air is moving around the castle also. So you get little wafts of cold air and wafts of warm air from the outside.
We're coming out from the gateway now into the inner ward, and this is the sort of the main courtyard of the castle, if you like, surrounded by lodgings and all the other buildings that were needed to really keep the garrison functioning from day to day. And over here, the dramatic well, cut right down through the rock, 80, 100 feet maybe. This must have been some feet through this geology.
And inside already you can see the colonisation going on, the recolonisation. There's hart's tongue fern, there's black spleen rocks cascading down. And in the far corner there's the site of a pied wagtail's nest, nesting just inside the top here. So again, using another niche, a strange niche really, actually slightly underground, and the protection that it's offered there.
So we're starting to explore the ground floor of the keep, and there's evidence this time of the year, of course, for birds nesting, taking advantage of the little nooks and crannies of the fabric. And indeed there's a poor abandoned egg there that's obviously dropped down from up a height somewhere.
Very, very early in the morning, if you go there when there are no other people there, in the gatehouse, there's the most wonderful sound of swallows, and you maybe get 20 or 30 swallows all roosting in there and all singing together, and I love that sound. Oh, it's like some wonderful music, and you're just inside it, and the echo of it and the way it resounds inside the gatehouse is like no other sound that I can think of. And then there are the tiny sounds as well. You can be there and it's very, very tranquil and peaceful. And suddenly you'll just hear a pigeon's wing as it flies from one ledge to another in the gatehouse.
It's interesting because they were domesticated from the wild rock dove to breed in dovecots. And the Lord of the Manor would have had a dovecot and filled with hundreds of breeding pairs in this sort of circular structure. The birds would go out and glean the land, and the young pigeons, called squabs, would have been harvested, basically, quite literally harvested as a valuable food source. But it was quite an elitist thing, because you had to have a dovecot and you had to be a Lord of the Manor to have that. And they were hated by the peasants, because the peasants actually gleaned the land themselves for grain and other things that the pigeons might eat. So the peasants themselves absolutely hated these dovecots and the Lords of the Manor who had them. And they went quickly out of fashion when turnips arrived in the country, and you could overwinter stock, so that meat then became a means of winter food. And up there somewhere, there would be possibly jackdaws breeding. They're certainly bred here in the past. And one of the towers has also had the peregrine breeding in that early last century.
Sometimes you hear starling, and the starlings are roosting there, and they're imitating other birds. They like to imitate the seabirds, so you might hear a curlew coming off the fields, or you might hear oyster catchers or redshanks down on the rocks. And then in the summertime, you might hear a starling imitating them, and you're not quite sure what you're listening to.
And we've now come down out of the defences of the castle and down towards the Egin Clough,
which is underneath the Margaret Tower at the end of the Curtain Wall. And that's a very strange, eerie place. It's a stony inlet full of big boulders. And it almost looks as though it's been carved by human hand, because it's very regular and rectangular. But in fact, it's just a natural fault. And the sea rushes in there and it crashes up against these boulders. It can really echo in there, and it has a strange, eerie, mysterious noise. It's like being inside a seashell. It's that wonderful spiral. You're going up the stairs inside the turret. And then you come out into the sunshine at the top, and you can see for miles and miles around you. And there's this wonderful landscape, because it's all slant. It's all sloping, and it's sloping towards the sea. And it's just like wave after wave of these open green fields.
And we've clambered up now onto the highest point that you can get to in the keep, and we're looking down on the seaward trace of the curtain wall.
Eider ducks can be seen here on a regular basis. In fact, one of the best places to watch eider ducks in their feeding creches is from the castle, and they have also been known to breed in the castle space, in the grass there. Mostly they breed on remote islands, and the Farne Islands certainly have a lot of birds breeding on there. But they don't feed around the Farne Islands. The little bobbing corks of chicks have to come to the shoreline for shallow waters. So they swim all the way from the Farne Islands to the coast and then spread out along the coast. And they can form these creches where you get a couple of adults, or maybe numerous adult females, looking after the chicks while the others can go off and feed. And you see these little black chicks, incredibly buoyant. Well, they have to be, as they feed in amongst the waves in the shallow waters, and they have to learn to get their own food there.
And in the distance to the south, you can see the little village of Craston, the chimneys smoking. And then away in the distance to the north, you can see Embleton. And further to the north, you can see Beadnall. So there are little pockets of habitation, but mostly it's just this vast, open landscape. And above you, the sky. And the sky is just enormous.
On a still evening in the autumn, you get seals gathering for the breeding on the Farne Islands. And there's a little rock called Outcar just north of here near Newton, where they haul out at low tide. So there's a lot of calling, and it comes over as a low sort of groan or moan or a luring sound, possibly. And maybe even been one of the stories behind sailors being lured.
Very often you look at the clouds and they're scratched and stretched and windblown and almost the same patterns that you see in the stone of the castle itself, and you just think that the whole thing is one thing and it's all been made by the wind.
I think that the allure of Dunstanbury is really that it was built as a show castle. It was built to look dramatic. It was built in a dramatic setting, and it retains all that drama today, all the care and attention that Thomas of Lancaster lavished on making his castle look good, paid off. It still looks incredibly impressive today. It does evoke everything that you want to see in a castle, really. It has mystery, it has that sort of dominance over the surrounding landscape, and a sense that as a ruin it's almost as powerful as it was the day it was built.
You've been listening to poet and historian Katrina Portus, National Trust Coastal Warden Kevin Redgrave, and archaeologists Al Oswald from English Heritage and Harry Beamish from the National Trust. The wildlife sound recordist was Chris Watson.